This is Religion Today with Martin Tanner, a weekly look at religion and spirituality here at home and around the world. Now, here's your host, Martin Tanner.
Welcome. This is Religion Today. I'm your host, Martin Tanner. Today, it is my great pleasure to introduce as our guest today, Jack Welch, who in 1979 founded FARMS, the Foundation for Ancient Research and Mormon Studies, which is now the Maxwell Institute. He has a wonderful resume. He's been the editor of BYU Studies, the director of publications for the Joseph Fielding Smith Institute for Latter-day Saint History, a member of the board of editors for the Encyclopedia of Mormonism, and the list could go on and on and on. He has received degrees from BYU, studied at Oxford, has a Juris Doctor from Duke University, and has for many years been a professor at J. Reuben Clark Law School. Most recently, he's been involved with the Smith Papers Project, which is absolutely fabulous. And as a young missionary, he discovered many instances of an ancient poetic form called chiasmus in the Book of Mormon, which is why he is here with us today. Welcome, Professor Welch.
Well, thank you, Martin. It's a real pleasure to be here. I'm very happy to share a bit about this fun and very interesting part of my life.
And it is an amazing part of your life. For people who don't know what chiasmus is, perhaps you could give a short little explanation.
Well, I will be speaking, as we'll be mentioning further in the program, at the two-day fair conference coming up the first week of August. I'll be giving more information and definitions there. But, you know, chiasmus has been known for a while, but most recently it has become of greater interest to biblical scholars and literary scholars all over the world. One of my topic at the fair conference will deal with chiasmus. And, you know, when you talk about criteria, how to define chiasmus, it can be defined fairly simply as just an arrangement of elements in a text that first says things in one order and then reverses that sequence and says them in the opposite order. So it can be as simple as an A-B-B-A kind of pattern, or much more extended, like A-B-C-D-E-E-D-C-B-A. Some of these patterns have a single pivot point at the center, and then people sometimes call them pivot patterns. They go by a lot of different names. Recently, Dwayne Christensen and others have been calling them menorah patterns if they have seven features to them. So they kind of look like a seven-candled menorah with a single point at the center. And a lot of variations in how chiasmus might be recognized or defined, and actually there's quite a cottage industry among biblical scholars and literary scholars to come up with definitions of, you know, what criteria should be used to identify the presence of chiasmus, and people write doctoral dissertations about the definition and the application of these principles. So your question, as simple as it might be, turns out to open a wonderful world of fascinating questions about how to read all kinds of texts.
Which is something people can learn more about if they happen to attend the fair conference, which will be on August 2nd and 3rd at the Southtown Expo Center in Sandy. If you'd like more information about the fair conference, which is open to the public, go on the internet to fairlds.org. I'm sure you would be welcome to attend. Everyone is, and it will be a wonderful opportunity to hear Professor Welch talk about chiasmus. This particular ancient literary form is something that's been used by biblical prophets and authors, and it certainly gives great weight to the claim of ancient authenticity of the Book of Mormon when that same kind of ancient poetic style is found in that document.
Well, that's certainly true. And that evidence or weight comes in a lot of different forms. Many people do consider the presence of chiasmus in the Book of Mormon to be very surprising and actually an amazing feature of that text. And, you know, for many years, the Book of Mormon was not carefully read at all. I remember reading Thomas O'Day's book, published back in 1957. He was a great American anthropologist. He accurately reported that many people considered, and I suppose some still do today, considered the Book of Mormon to be one of those books you don't have to read in order to have an opinion of, which, talk about judging a book by its cover, that's an extreme version of that. But when I was growing up, back in the 50s and 60s, people actually thought very little about the Book of Mormon, partly because they just didn't read or think about the Book of Mormon much at all. So when something as potentially eloquent and really profound comes along as chiasmus, which is extensive, subtle, and purposeful in this text, it at least requires people to, you know, look much harder at the Book of Mormon and take it more respectfully and seriously as well. And I think that's happened, and for many, many reasons. It's not just a question of whether the book is an ancient book or not, although that's certainly a very important part of the discussion. As my title at the Fair Conference will discuss, I'm going to be talking about what chiasmus proves and what it does not prove. And it's really pretty astonishing that it proves much, much more than just giving evidence of origin. The weight of this argument comes because it helps us to understand so many features of the text, the nature and meaning of a passage, its beauty, its aesthetic qualities, intertextual relations and comparative analysis between the way one author tells a story and the way another author tells a similar story. It can give us a lot of insights that are really fascinating. And to me, the more people realize that the Book of Mormon is not a shallow, simple, rough-cut, dictated book, but one that has a much richer heritage and background than we have usually even imagined. It says a lot about the profundity of this text and why it can move people as deeply as it does. When you talk about weight, giving weight to the book, well, the word profound has to do with weight. And this book is a weighty text. And because of that, it has substance and can do wonderful things for lots of people in many situations. And I think chiasmus is a tool in helping us to understand all of that.
Well, so very well said. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Professor Jack Welch. He's a professor of law at Brigham Young University's J. Reuben Clark Law School, although he's done so much, much more than that. He was the founder of Farms, and he's here today to talk to us a little bit about how he found chiasmus and what it proves and what it does not prove in the book about the Book of Mormon. And he will be speaking at the upcoming Fair Conference that will be held on August 2nd and 3rd, Thursday and Friday. The public is welcome. There is a charge to attend. So when we come back, we'll hear more from Professor Welch about how he learned about chiasmus and how he discovered it in the Book of Mormon, which is a fascinating story. Stay tuned. I'm Martin Tanner. This is Religion Today.
Today with Martin Tanner continues on KSL News Radio 102.7 FM and 1160 AM.
Welcome back. I'm Martin Tanner. This is Religion Today. If you're just joining us, my guest today is Professor Jack Welch, who founded FARMS, the Foundation for Ancient Research in Mormon Studies, and who discovered chiasmus in the Book of Mormon. He will be speaking about that and specifically about what chiasmus does and does not prove at the upcoming FAIR conference, which will be held August 2nd and 3rd in Sandy, Utah. If you'd like more details, check it out on the internet on fairlds.org. Professor Welch, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
My distinct pleasure. Maybe today, at this point in our interview, it would be appropriate for you to tell us a little bit about how you first learned about chiasmus, and then about how you discovered it in the Book of Mormon. I would love to hear that.
Well, with an emphasis on little bit, because it is a complicated story, let me just go back to 1967, when I was a 20-year-old missionary serving in Regensburg, Germany. I had studied at the University of Salzburg a little, and I had had Hugh Nibley as my Book of Mormon teacher before going on my mission, but I had never heard about chiasmus, and very few people in those days had. My companion and I saw a notice posted outside the cathedral at Regensburg announcing a series of lectures that would be given on Friday mornings in the priest's seminar there in Regensburg. And because Friday morning was our time off, our P-Day, and our missionary rules allowed us to go to cultural events like that, I thought it would be really a good event, and maybe we could make some friends with Catholic scholars and students by attending a lecture like this. So we went. And the lecture dealt with the use of chiasmus by Matthew, comparing Matthew's style with Mark's writing. The professor had just recently read a book that had been published by Paul Gechter, a Jesuit, about Matthew's literary art, and he was excited about what this helped him to understand about the authorship and the uniqueness and the structure of the Gospel of Matthew. He particularly argued that Matthew was more Hebraic than Mark, that Mark was writing mainly to a Gentile audience and Matthew to a Jewish audience, and therefore Matthew tended to use chiasmus more than Mark, or at least in different ways, as subsequent scholarship might state it. But I was fascinated with the idea, and on our way home, we stopped at the Catholic bookstore close to where we lived, and they happened to have a copy of this little monograph that the professor had been referring to. I bought it, spent the next week or so eagerly reading it, and reread the Gospel of Matthew with that in mind as a tool to help me appreciate and understand Matthew, and I found that it just helped me a lot to understand Matthew's organization and emphasis on key points that turn out to be turning points or high points in the chiastic structures that he uses. I didn't give it much more thought for a few days, but many pieces soon fell into place, and early on the morning of August the 16th, I had a prompting to get out of bed, and the prompting gave me the idea that if it was evidence of Hebrew style in the Bible, it had to be evidence of Hebrew style in the Book of Mormon. And I got out of bed, and it was, you know, one of those experiences where you open the book. I opened the Book of Mormon, turned a page, and there was Mosiah chapter 5, verses 10 to 12. And one of the best examples of chiasmus in the Book of Mormon. And that was, believe me, a very exciting moment to see all of that come together. Well, that was just a first step in a long journey of studying and publishing and really for the last 45 years, engaging in conversations with all kinds of people about chiasmus in the Book of Mormon, in the Bible, in lots of literatures. I've created an archive, and one of the reasons I'm speaking at FAIR about chiasmus is to tell people more about the current bibliography and archive that we have that I've been collecting, gathering papers, and correspondence, and books, and articles, and all kinds of things over the last 45 years about chiasmus. You know, these come from serious scholars, from fascinated explorers, and from cautious critics, and all have been marvelous to communicate with. So, Martin, in a nutshell, that's kind of how it all got started.
And what a fascinating story it is. I remember just being gripped with how important this was to me when I first understood this, because certainly there is virtually no chance that Joseph Smith, in his particular circumstances as a young man at the time that he translated the Book of Mormon, could possibly have known about chiasmus and been capable, even if he had, of putting together such amazingly complex chiastic structures as we find in some places in the Book of Mormon. That discovery, following your discovery, was frankly life-changing for me too.
Well, that's right, and it's a very complicated matter. You know, people have wondered, what were the chances? Could Joseph Smith have learned about this through academic channels? You know, possibly. In my 1969 article, which I wrote as an undergraduate and published in BYU Studies, I talk about sources that were available, at least in England, published in 1820 and 1824. I don't think that Joseph knew of any of those sources, but like you say, even if he did, what are the chances that he could have composed fluently and without notes, as he dictated the Book of Mormon, these kinds of complicated structures? Now, you know, what does the Book of Mormon ask us to do? It asks us to pray about these things, to take it seriously, to receive a testimony through the power of the Holy Ghost, whether it's true or not. But a careful study of the Book of Mormon from many different angles, including its literary form, can help people to get to the point where they will say, well, maybe there is something to this. Maybe I can't explain this as simply as I once thought. And for me, if it will bring people to that point where they say, well, God has invited me to ask whether it's true or not, I'll give it a try. Well, then I think our study has been fruitful.